Please turn to page 972 in your Bibles. The reading is Matthew chapter 7, verse 28 to chapter 8, verse 22. When Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, because he taught as one who had authority, and not as their teachers of the law. When Jesus came down from the mountainside, large crowds followed him. A man with leprosy came and knelt before him and said, "Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean." Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. "I am willing," he said. "Be clean." Immediately he was cleansed of his leprosy. Then Jesus said to him, "See that you don't tell anyone, but go, show yourself to the priest and offer the gift Moses commanded as a testimony to them." When Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him, asking for help. "Lord," he said, "my servant lies at home, paralyzed, suffering terribly." Jesus said to him, "Shall I come and heal him?" The centurion replied, "Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the word and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority, with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes, and that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it." When Jesus heard this, he was amazed and said to those following him, "Truly I tell you, I have not found anyone in Israel with such great faith. I say to you that many will come from the east and the west and will take their places at the feast with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the subject of the kingdom will be thrown outside into the darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." Then Jesus said to the centurion, "Go, let it be done just as you believed it would." And his servant was healed at that moment. When Jesus came into Peter's house, he saw Peter's mother-in-law lying in bed with a fever. He touched her hand, and the fever left her, and she got up and began to wait on him. When evening came, many who were demon-possessed were brought to him, and he drove out the spirits with a word and healed all who were ill. This was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah. "He took up our infirmities and bore our diseases." When Jesus saw the crowd around him, he gave orders to cross to the other side of the lake. Then a teacher of the law came to him and said, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." Jesus replied, "Foxes have dens and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." Another disciple said to him, "Lord, first let me go and bury my father." But Jesus told him, "Follow me and let the dead bury their own dead."
I promise you strong and stable leadership. Of course, that's not what I'm promising you this afternoon, though I do hope I don't falter too much as I speak. But that was the soundbite that followed Theresa May throughout her entire tenure as Prime Minister. Strong and stable leadership. A promise of authority. Authority to deliver Brexit and unite an ununited kingdom. But as we know, she was unable to demonstrate that authority. The discussions with the EU went south. She had a record defeat in Parliament over her Brexit deal. And just this week, she announced that she was resigning after being pushed out by her party. She couldn't demonstrate her authority. And as a result, people didn't want to follow her. They rejected her authority and wanted to follow someone else. I'm sure you can think of similar experiences you've had with authority where you've either had to reject it or submit to it. Maybe laws we obey, things like red lights or speed limits, or maybe those are the ones you reject. Think of positions of authority you've held and whether people have rejected or submitted to you. Parents, you'll know you have an authoritative position with your children, don't you? As an expectant father myself, I anticipate the children always do exactly what you tell them to and submit. Well, unlike Theresa May and our parental responsibilities, in our passage today, we see an unrivaled authority, one that asks us for a response. We're starting a new series in Matthew 8, picking up at the end of the Sermon of the Mount, which is something saplings are currently looking at. So if you have any questions about that part of it, do go ask them. They'll be experts by now. And at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus has been teaching great truths. And as we come into chapters 8 and 9, we see Jesus start to do some great things. In this passage, there's a lot going on, but we're going to pick up on three major themes that run through it and think about what it means for us. And the first theme is one we've already been sort of thinking about, the authority of Jesus. This is introduced right at the beginning of our reading. We just had at the end of chapter 7, verses 28 and 29. When Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowd were amazed at his teaching because he taught as one who had authority and not as their teachers of the law. We lead on from this incredible sermon where Jesus demonstrates his authority through words into chapter 8 where Jesus demonstrates his authority through works. And in our passage today, that authority is demonstrated in the act of healing. In verse 16, we're told that Jesus healed all those that were brought to him with illness. So in a sense, it's not a rare occurrence that Jesus heals people. It's not something unexpected. In fact, that's how Jesus begins his ministry in chapter 4 of Matthew's gospel, healing every disease and illness among the people. But in chapter 8, we have these three healings that are given special prominence by Matthew, something he clearly wants to highlight. So we're going to have a look at Jesus' authority and focus particularly on his encounter with the leper. Jesus has come down from the mountain, and the leper approaches him, kneels, showing his respect for Jesus, and says, verse 2, Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean. The leper has no doubt over Jesus' ability to make him clean. He says, you can make me clean. You can do it if you are willing. He recognizes that Jesus has an authority over his disease, and all that Jesus needs to do is will for him to be healed, and it will happen. And Jesus' response is surprising. Look at verse 3. He says, Jesus reached out his hand and touched him. I am willing, he said, be clean. It may not seem surprising to us, those who know these healing stories quite well, but lepers were not considered only infectious from a medical point of view, but also from a spiritually and ceremonial point of view. They were complete outcasts from Jewish society. And even the temple, to touch a leper was to become unclean, as well as risk infection from their disease. If you don't know leprosy, it's a really horrible disease. It affects the skin, devastating the skin, and can even cause parts of the body to fall off, like fingers and toes, or at least disform them dramatically. If you saw someone with an infectious disease like that, would you touch them? But it wasn't the leper's uncleanliness that was contagious, but Jesus' purity. End of verse 3, we see it says, he was cleansed of his leprosy immediately. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't know any medical cures or treatments that work instantaneously and 100% effectively. With all of our research and studies and years treating illness, we're only ever fighting against it, even with our most effective treatments, pushing back on infections and viruses, treating symptoms, trying to remove the cause, but not Jesus. Jesus doesn't have to diagnose and analyze and come up with a treatment plan for the illness. No, he just tells it to leave. Could you imagine if a doctor had that authority over sickness? That would be a private healthcare worth paying for. That's the authority Jesus has over sickness. And interestingly, what does Jesus instruct the leper to do now he's been healed and made clean? Look at verse 4. Jesus said to him, "See that you don't tell anyone, but go. Show yourself to the priest and offer the gift Moses commanded as a testimony to them." Now that gift, if you don't know it, it's outlined in Leviticus 14. It's the routines that someone would follow once they were clean of a skin disease. It was a gift that was the way of the priest confirming they were clean and bringing them back into society, back into a relationship with God's people and an ability to go to the temple again where they could engage ceremonially with God. This would be a testimony to those priests of Jesus' authority over sickness. And even though he says, don't tell anyone, which might seem contradictory, because he's a testament, It's actually Jesus reminding the leper and us today of the dangers of attracting enthusiasm for the wrong reasons. Jesus isn't just a magic healer. He's a promised Messiah that reconciles people to God. And it's not just in the healing of the leper that we see Jesus' authority over sickness. We see it twice more, and both in slightly different ways. Firstly, with the centurion's servant, Jesus doesn't even see who he's healing. He just says in verse 13, "Go, let it be done just as you believed it would." And his servant was healed at that moment. That's the centurion's servant, healed in a moment from a word. But it's not just a verbal command from Jesus that brings about healing. We see soon that he heals Peter's mother-in-law with just a touch. And this bedridden lady hops up and immediately starts waiting on Jesus. Now, the lesson here is not that when we encounter Jesus, we should make more tea and coffee, as lovely as that might be, but it demonstrates Jesus' authority to completely annihilate sickness, completely transform someone. Peter's mother-in-law goes from someone bedridden and ill to physically serving. It's a complete turnaround. Jesus has authority to heal with a touch, or a word, or both. He's not like a magician who needs to perfectly maneuver cards in order to maintain an illusion. He has authority to drive out sickness, not by what he does, but by who he is. Which is what we come to after the healings. Matthew tells us, have a look at verse 17, that these healings were to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah. He took up our infirmities and bore our diseases. It's a quote from Isaiah 53, where we're given a picture of God's suffering yet glorified servant. A picture of Jesus going to the cross, suffering our pace, bearing our pain and our sin. These healings are a glimpse of the kingdom of heaven won through death and the resurrection of Jesus. That's where we see this Isaiah passage fulfilled completely, at the cross, when Jesus put to death our sickness, our sin and our suffering. It's like a window into a house. We're not in the kingdom of heaven, but we can see a glimpse of what it might be like. And at the moment, of course, we still see these things. We still know sickness and suffering and sin. But this passage shows us a glimpse of the kingdom of heaven, a kingdom without sickness and suffering because Jesus has eradicated it. A kingdom where we're all reconciled to God. A kingdom where we're all welcomed, as we'll see shortly. And a kingdom where we're no longer dirty from sin, but made clean through faith in Jesus. We don't see that kingdom fully realized now, but one day we will, when Jesus returns, an endless to sickness, suffering, and sin. So we can and should still pray now for healing, because Jesus' authority hasn't changed. But at the same time, we should be cautious not to necessarily expect it, because we're not in that kingdom yet. We're only in a partial realization of it. God is healer and can heal. But he's already dealt with sickness and suffering and sin once for all through Jesus on the cross. Now that to me is the most amazing thing and a glorious reassurance. We see an amazing Jesus, an authoritative Jesus. We see a glimpse of the kingdom of heaven. If you saw someone like that, how would you respond? Well, let's have a look at Jesus' encounter with the centurion, which will help us think about that. This is the second thing we see. We've seen the authority of Jesus, and now we come to see the faith of the centurion. The faith of the centurion. Jesus comes into Capernaum. It's a fishing village, likely home to some of the disciples, a familiar place. And a centurion, who might well know him from being around, comes to ask Jesus for help, saying, "Lord, my servant lies at home paralyzed, suffering terribly." To which Jesus responds, "Shall I come and heal him?" The centurion outlines his problem, and Jesus offers a solution. It seems relatively straightforward. We know Jesus can heal sickness. We've just seen him do it. But what stands out here is how the centurion responds to Jesus' offer. A response that we're told in verse 10 amazes Jesus. He says, verse 8 and 9, "Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the word and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes, and that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it." The centurion not only humbles himself before Jesus, saying, "I'm not worthy for you to come into my house," but he speaks about his position in the Roman army. Seems like an odd segue from what they were talking about. You see, the centurion was in charge of 100 Roman soldiers. That's where the name comes from. He commanded these men, and when he commanded them, he didn't do it on his authority, but he did it with the authority of Rome behind him, the whole of the Roman Empire. And in saying that, he recognizes that in Jesus. Jesus has authority over sickness because he's under authority from above, from the Father. In the same way that when the centurion speaks with the full backing of Rome, the source of his authority, when Jesus speaks, he speaks with the backing of the kingdom of heaven, the source of his authority. So no wonder Jesus is amazed at this response. This Gentile soldier, a commander from an enemy occupying force, recognizes who Jesus is as someone with authority from God, sent from the kingdom of heaven. And in recognizing who Jesus is, he puts his faith in Jesus to heal his servant. Just say the word and he'll be healed. The soldier shows his faith by trusting Jesus. Just as we show faith in chairs, we know that the chairs will hold our weight here today. We believe that they'll hold our weight, but we only demonstrate that faith when we sit down and put our trust in them. We've just heard in the baptism of Maisie make those declarations, I believe and trust in Jesus. And that's what the centurion is doing here. He's believing and trusting in Jesus. He doesn't need to see Jesus heal his servant. He doesn't need to see the evidence. He just says, say the word and it will be done. He trusts in Jesus. And of course, in that moment, that's what happens. Verse 13, his servant was healed at that moment. Of course, the centurion won't see that until later when he returns home. But he's seen Jesus' authority. He's seen where it comes from, and he responds to it by trusting in Jesus. Maybe what makes that more amazing is the contrast with who Jesus has already seen in Israel. He says in verse 10, truly, I tell you, I've not found anyone in Israel with such great faith. He says, I've not found anyone in God's chosen people who has this faith in me. It's pretty amazing that out of anyone who could recognize Jesus for who he is, it's an outsider. And that's a point Jesus drives home in verses 11 and 12. He says, I say to you that many will come from the east and the west and will take their places at the feast with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the subjects of the kingdom will be thrown outside into darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. It's not a very nice picture for the Jewish people. The Jewish people were God's chosen people. The nation of Israel were God's chosen nation. But Jesus is saying that people from the east and the west, nations other than Israel, well, they'll be sat at the feast in the kingdom of heaven, while those who thought themselves subjects of the kingdom will be thrown out into darkness with weeping and gnashing of teeth. It's not a nice picture at all. But why is it? Why would they get thrown out while others get accepted? Well, because those who are being accepted, those from other nations, they're responding to who Jesus is by placing their trust in him. In contrast, those who think they're safe, who aren't trusting Jesus, says here they're cast out of the kingdom. Imagine if you had a rich aunt. She owns land, mansions, horses, boats, the whole works, and you're her only living relative. You know of her, you know about her, who she is, but you've never made any sort of relationship with her. And then one day you hear that she's passed away, and she's left all of that great stuff, the houses and the horses, in her will. You might be pretty excited if you're a bit cynical like me. You might think, jackpot. She's no one else to leave that to. And when you get to the will reading, you hear that actually it's not you, her blood, her family, who you are, that's got the inheritance, but actually people you never knew, her neighbors, her friends, people that had a relationship with her, that knew her and cared about her, turned to her for support and love, and loved her in return. When you think of that image, it seems silly to think you might have a right to that inheritance just because of who you are. And that's what we're seeing here. Jesus is saying that in Israel, lots of people think they're safe. They think they'll inherit the kingdom because of who they are as people of Israel. But that's not the case because they're not turning to Jesus whilst other people are. It's a stark message for us today. It's an encouragement for outsiders, people who might think they're too far away from God, that they're outside of God's love, but also a warning to insiders. Jesus welcomes anyone. Whether you've been at church your whole life or whether this is your very first time, Jesus welcomes anyone. We see that in the three healings. He heals a leper, an outcast of Jewish society, for the centurion, a Gentile, the polar opposite of a Jew, and a woman, a second-class citizen in Jewish culture. Jesus welcomes anyone. Anyone who puts their faith and trust in him will have a place at that feast. Isn't that a glorious image? But it's also a reminder to those of us who would say we are trusting in Jesus. Do we have the same confidence in Jesus that the centurion and the leper do? They accept that they are weak and that Jesus is strong, that they need him because they can't solve their problems themselves. They look to him and trust him. They see who he is, his authority, and they put their faith in him. And maybe we feel like we don't always do that. I know that I don't. Maybe we start to feel safe and we get complacent to think we can get by on our own, solve our own problems, overcome our own temptations, that we don't need Jesus because that would mean admitting we're weak, which a lot of us would rather not do. We try to build ourselves up to look strong rather than look to him who is already strong. Jesus wants us to see his authority and respond by placing our trust in him. And we see here that that's a natural response to seeing Jesus and experiencing him. We've seen this amazing, authoritative Jesus. We've seen who he is and what he can do. We've glimpsed the kingdom of heaven that's to come. Who wouldn't want to follow someone like that? And that's what happens at the end of this passage. People start flocking to him, eager to follow him. And that's when we see this third and final theme of the passage, the cost of following. The cost of following. In verse 18, Jesus sees the crowd. And he gives orders to cross the other side of the lake. And two men come up to him. The first, the teacher of the law, says this, verse 19. Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go. Now, Jesus doesn't exactly tell him no, but he doesn't encourage him either. He says in verse 20, foxes have dens and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. It's a bit of an odd response. Maybe not one we'd give someone if they said they'll come with us in the car or something. But Jesus is making a point in neither affirming nor rejecting the man's intention. He's not saying you can't follow me or that you should, but rather that there's a cost to following me. There's something you need to know. Maybe if you've ever planned a holiday abroad, you might have gone to gov.uk where there's a foreign travel advice section. And it tells you everything you might need to know a country, including security risks and terrorism threats. You don't get told don't go here because it's too dangerous. You get told what you might need to know to make a decision. Anything you might need to understand before committing. And that's what Jesus is doing. He's saying, you can come with me, but here's what you're going to need to understand. Foxes and birds will have more certain homes than you. You may not be in control of where you live. You'll have to let go. And the warning is clear in that response. If you can't deal with that, then you're not ready to follow me wherever I'll go. Following me is going to be difficult. And I wonder if we always think about this. Are we aware that following Jesus fully may mean giving up control? Control that we so desperately crave? Or maybe you're aware of the cost and you think that's something for later. That's when things get a bit difficult. I'll come to that after a bit. Well, maybe that's you, but let's have a look at the second man. He comes to Jesus and says, verse 21, Lord, first let me go and bury my father. I'm willing to follow you and bury that cross, Jesus. Once my father is in the ground and I don't need to worry about him anymore. Verse 22, Jesus responds, follow me and let the dead bury their own dead. It's almost a command. Follow me and leave them to it. It's Jesus being authoritative and the disciple can now choose to do what he says or not. But Jesus is saying, I'm more important than your family. Leave them behind. It's a pretty daunting cost. And you can see why the disciple might not be wanting to put following, he might want to put following Jesus on hold and make an excuse for why he's not ready just yet. I will follow you, but first I just need to bury my father. I wonder how familiar that sentence sounds to you. Maybe not the bury your father bit, but I will follow you, but first I just need to. Maybe it's a case of following Jesus completely. I will follow you. But first, Jesus, I just want to finish my degree. I will follow you, Jesus, but first I need to find the right person to marry. I will follow you, Jesus, once I've got the right job. Or maybe it's smaller steps. I will read my Bible, Jesus, once I've done the washing up. I will read my Bible, Jesus, once I've gone for a shop for the week. I will sit and pray once I've had breakfast, and then of course you need to rush to beat the traffic, and it doesn't happen. We all do these things. Certainly I do. We see this amazing, authoritative Jesus who gives us a glimpse of the kingdom of heaven, and we put him after our shopping for the week, instead of first in everything. I wonder what stops you, what you'd find difficult to sacrifice, what distracts you. Maybe it's your jobs that are a distraction. Maybe it is your families. They make us complacent in our relationship with Jesus. These aren't wrong things, but they can often find their ways to becoming wrong priorities, can't they? And is Jesus saying here that we all need to become homeless and have no families? Maybe that's what we're thinking, but no, that's not what he's saying. He's just painting a picture in black and white, in big, bold strokes, so we understand the point. He's saying, give your life to me. Give up control and turn to me. And that might mean having to turn our backs on something we know is not productive when we're walking with Jesus. And that might be hard, but let me ask you something. All of us here today, whether you've heard this 1,000 times or whether this is the first time you're really thinking about it, those glimpses we see of the kingdom of heaven here, an eternal kingdom without sickness, sin, suffering, with God, all together, do we weigh that correctly against the things that we may have to sacrifice, the difficulties we may have to face? Do we live like this is true, like there's this crown of glory at the end, but we have to pick up our daily cross? Isn't that reward worth everything? What appears now to be an overwhelming amount of sickness, pain, suffering, and hardship, well, that pales next to the glory of the kingdom. It might mean we need to just get up earlier so we have some chance to read our Bible before we get rushed off to work. It might mean putting something else on hold, like our shop, until we've had an opportunity to sit and pray. What Jesus says here is he wants us to follow him wholeheartedly, knowing it will be difficult, and sacrificing that which stops us. And as a result, we'll be with him for eternity with no more pain, no sickness, no suffering, no sin. He wants to know what our response is. Let's just take a moment of quiet to reflect, think about maybe what your distractions are, what you'd find difficult to sacrifice, and then I'll close us in prayer in a moment.